Well, let's go ahead and get started. I trust that you can see and you can hear me. That's my everything that I see says we can, so that's good. And let's begin with a word of prayer. If you please, if you're able to, bow with me as I pray. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for today, for your kindness to us. Lord, thank you for all that you've done. Thank you for allowing us to gather together tonight to be able to look into your word and to be hopefully shaped by your word and to be challenged by your word so that our worldview and our ideas come from your word and not we don't impose those upon the scriptures. Lord, I ask that you would just be gracious to us tonight in Christ's name. Amen. Well, before I begin the Bible study tonight, what I want to do is I would like to just briefly talk about a couple things here. I'd like to talk about the plans for in a few coming weeks. Well, actually, in 2 Sundays. I mentioned on Sunday morning, let me change my little posture here, there we go, I think it's a little better, mentioned on Sunday morning that I have a plan that I'm working on to get in-person services back up and running, and the plan is, not this Sunday, but the next Sunday, I believe I said the 31st in my announcements on Sunday, but it's actually in 10 days from now, that the plan would be for that. And we found out tonight, I believe Governor Walz indicated that some of the restrictions are being lessened. Some of the governor's stay-at-home orders are being loosened, which is a blessing. So that's great. I've been hoping and praying to that end. And so I don't have the full picture of what in 10 days Sunday will look like, but I do want to say that the goal is to have those who want to gather together in person to be able to have a time we can do that. Plan to, if I can talk to the Bushes or the Roberts when it comes to communion bread, have that done so we can do that on Sunday. Plan to do that in a kind of a unique way, but also have a live stream service so that those of us who are still would rather stay home and rather for various reasons concerning whether you're sick with the flu or whether you're concerned with taking care of someone who's more at risk with the COVID-19 stuff, any of those things, the goal would be to have still a live stream option that would include what we have been in these past number of weeks, singing and the sermon. So I'm going to have some more details coming out, but this week we're going to send out an email of just kind of a general requesting for your feedback is, yes, I plan to come on Sunday, the 24th, I believe, and me and my family are going to be coming. That's the plan, barring some other providential hindrance with, car not working, getting sick, those kinds of things. And once we have that information, I'm going to try to craft a plan for Sunday, and it's probably going to look like multiple different times of gatherings on Sunday, where there'll be smaller groups, and we'll get those details out. But again, we want to be, we want to gather together. We want to have start to move back into post pandemic lockdown church, and so we're moving towards that end. So again, I you can pray for me and Lon as we work through these things, and then just give us patience as we try to get things back into normal, back to normal, not a new normal, but back to normal that we can have churches we are all missing. I had a conversation this week with someone and he said, essentially, I didn't know how much I would miss church until I've not It's not been an option. This is someone who's been a believer for many years and who's faithful, is faithful, you know, to our church. And I'm grateful for this individual. And but he said, I didn't realize how much I really miss church or would miss church, the gathering together of the believers in person. And I think that is probably been felt by most of us, probably in one way, shape, or form. I think that can be one of those good blessings that comes out of this strange time, is how much we prize gathering together. I know I've been blessed by individuals coming by the office, calling me on the phone, talking to me for a long time when I call them, or stopping by the house to encourage, or just different things. And we all miss that fellowship. We all miss that camaraderie that we can have that you really can't have as much and as easily and as good through screens all the time. So we're looking forward to that, and I'm excited. And again, just keep me and Lon in your prayers as we strive to make wise decisions and be as faithful and as thoughtful as we can be. And then just reply to those emails when they get sent out. So that's all a little bit of preamble to our study tonight. But we're in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 tonight. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And 1 Corinthians is a book where I was told one time years and years ago that a pastor says, whenever I go to a new church — this is someone who'd been at, you know, several new churches over the course of his, you know, 20 to 25 years of ministry — and he'd go to a new church about every 3 or 4 or 5 years for whatever reason — he said, whenever I go there, I preach through 1 Corinthians, because I don't know the church very well and they don't know me, but when you go through 1 Corinthians, you're going to deal with a lot of issues. And you'll probably hit an issue or multiples of that church in itself is dealing with. And so we are dealing with some very basic, very, very important issues as we look at 1 Corinthians here. We've looked at a bunch of them, and this one this morning or this evening, notwithstanding, is also very important. So I'm just going to go ahead and read 1 Corinthians chapter 7 here. If you want to read with me in your scriptures here, and read the first 7 verses. 1 Corinthians 7, 1 says this: "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. Husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But this I say by way of concession, not of command. Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." So as it has been the recent history in this book, Paul is again dealing with this kind of perennial problem of sin as it relates to sexual sin that he's been dealing with since chapter 5. Remember, chapter 5 began with the reporting of the man who was having a sexual relationship with his stepmother. And then in chapter 6, lawsuits were being talked about, and then including that, there was the issue of immorality being rebuked, and then the fact that immorality was, or sexuality was, not merely a physical thing. You need to take care of your body, because the Lord Christ has redeemed you and he will resurrect your body, so don't treat it as a discardable thing. So he's dealing with the same kind of general area of sin, and he's talking now into the realm of marriage. Now, I've said often that the biblical truth is that marriage, heterosexual monogamous marriage, is the only place in the scriptures where sexuality, sexual activity, sexual intercourse is both approved of and it is encouraged and commanded, really, for numbers of reasons. But this is important as a foundational reality of our understanding of the Bible. I was reading a book, boy, it must have been 10 years ago. I have to look at the publication of the book. But it was called A Strange Thing Happened in America, and it was a book by a guy named Michael Brown, who's a charismatic apologist. He's a charismatic guy. He's not an apologist, but he's known for his Jewish apologetics. He writes questions to Jewish answers. And he also, so he's known for that in a lot of circles. And he wrote this book cataloging the cultural shift and the cultural way in which our country's minds have been changed as relates to sexuality in general. He was focused on the issue of homosexuality particularly, but he was making the point in that book that there is this pervasive problem of sexual immorality in the culture that goes back even before that to issues of divorce and of even consequenceless sex outside of marriage. Al Mohler, in his book We Cannot Be Silent, I think he wrote a couple years ago, similar on the similar general subject, traced a lot of the root of societal problem that we see manifesting in our society now, when it comes to immorality, debauchery, and other kinds of sinful activities or sinful sexual expressions, back to an original compromises on the biblical place for sex and marriage. And Michael Brown, and one of the things in his book that I really appreciated is that he presented the biblical discussion of issues, particularly of same-sex marriage, or not say, well, not same-sex marriage, biblical discussion of homosexuality, as a comprehensive argument that, though it only specifically mentions that kind of activity a handful of times directly, the entire Bible itself is an argument when it talks about sex or marriage or whatever else, is done so in the context of heterosexual monogamous marriage. He compared it to a cookbook that said, like, if you bought a cookbook, a gluten-free cookbook or a sugar-free cookbook, and on the intro, the title page, it said, all these recipes are made without gluten, or all these recipes are made without sugar. That alone would be sufficient as to not need to talk about gluten and sugar on the other 500 pages of the cookbook. There might be a notation here or there about, you know, different aspects of something in this particular recipe, but overall, it was taken care of at the beginning, and the entire book was built on the foundation. Similarly, marriage and sexuality, the Bible, the only foundation for proper understanding and sexual activity is heterosexual monogamous marriage. And so that's really the base upon which Paul is doing all of his teaching here. And now we come to this chapter 7, and just as a little bit of a warning, but an important statement here, there are several things in these particularly 7 verses that are sometimes difficult to really nail down as to exactly what Paul was saying. I think I understand what he's saying, and I have the proper way to walk through these things that makes the most sense contextually and biblically. But historically, even among faithful, believing Bible teachers, there's been some disagreement, not over the foundational, fundamental issues, but essentially, what is Paul arguing exactly in a couple of these verses? And I'll show you this here in a minute. Really, it starts off in verse 1 here. Verse 1, he says this, "Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." Now, this is on your handouts, if you were able to print one, and I apologize for the late and this and them being sent out. I sent them to Nancy late tonight. But it's number one is a matter of correspondence. A matter of correspondence. One of the things that's important about this book is that in chapter one, Paul says that he's heard about these divisions in the Corinthian church from Chloe's people. And in chapter 5, he said it's actually reported among you, or that there's immorality among you. And in chapter 7, he talks about how in a previous letter, correspondence, they brought these things up. So Paul's not been present with his church for a while, but there has been news back and forth, interaction back and forth. And here, part of the difficulty in this section is we don't have the letter before the letter that the Corinthians sent to Paul before 1 Corinthians. And so we have to try to figure out exactly how to begin this paragraph here. For instance, some commentators and some theologians wonder if the phrase "it is good for a man not to touch a woman" should rather be "is it good for a man not to touch a woman" as a question. In other words, did the Corinthians write in their letter to them a question? Is it good for a man not to touch a woman? Question mark. Or it could be that they had written a kind of a defiant stance that it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Or is this Paul saying as a statement, a blanket statement of, hey, I'm going to talk to you about things you wrote. First point, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And really, it's difficult to be dogmatic about that because there is not that clarity in some of the language. The way in which I have, I think, come to the best understanding of what Paul is doing here is this. Paul says, concerning what you wrote, and then he's as if putting quotation marks around, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And actually, if you have the English Standard Version, that's what they do in that translation. They put quotation marks around that phrase. In other words, he's quoting that from them, and he's going to use that as a jumping off point. Now, I think that's what he's doing, and some of my favorite expositors actually take a different approach and say, this is Paul just saying the blanket statement, it's good to not touch a woman. In other words, immorality. In other words, it is a good thing to abstain from sexual immorality, and that's kind of what he's saying. I don't think that's what he's saying, but again, good godly men would say otherwise. But I think that Paul is saying here, he's quoting them, because just flip back in your Bibles if you want to, or actually don't have to flip back, just look just a few verses earlier in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 12. Understanding verses 12 and 13, as we went through that, the way that I think is best understood is Paul is responding to this statement in the church, in the Corinthian culture, in the Corinthian church. Food is for the stomach, and stomach is for food, therefore it doesn't matter what you do. Sex is for the body, and the body is for sex, therefore it doesn't matter what you do, because it's all going to be burned up anyway. He was using that kind of their own ideas and trying to take it and then correct that thinking, which is, I think, what he's doing here. This statement that it is good for a man not to touch a woman as a statement they put in their letter to him. Whether it was a question or an actual kind of this is our conviction, he's going to take it and now he's going to address it and correct their misunderstanding and their misunderstanding and misapplication. So we have a matter of correspondence. Again, Paul is here dealing with this question they brought up. Now, again, when it comes to it is good for a man not to touch a woman, that is really properly understood as touching, not just as an accidental kind of bumping into someone as you're walking through Kroger's or something. Do we even have Kroger's down here? Have I ever been to a Kroger's? I think I've been to a Kroger's once a long time ago. As you're walking through Target or Walmart or wherever it might be, and even prior to, you know, social distancing, he's not talking about accidentally bumping into a woman or accidentally bumping into somebody else. There's this idea of an intentional touch. But more than that, even in the Old Testament, sometimes this use of the language of touch is euphemistically referring to sexual activity. Turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 20. I'm going to read from Proverbs as we do this, but turn to Genesis chapter 20, And while we're turning there, I'm going to read another section from Proverbs. But in Proverbs chapter 6, let's see here. Well, if I talk while I flip, I miss my flip, my place here. There you go. Proverbs chapter 6. We have this kind of language about where the same kind of wording is used in the Septuagint, again, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, of this touching referring to intimacy. And again, because Paul says, and as I think what he's saying, that they had said to him, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And the understanding there, I think, is sexual interaction, sexual contact. Starting in verse Proverbs 6, verse 23, I'll read a few verses here. It says this. For the commandment is a lamp, and the light, and the teaching is light, and reproofs for discipline are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. For on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread, and an adulteress hunts for the precious life. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? Verse 29. So is the one who goes in to his neighbor's wife, who touches her will not, whoever touches her will not go unpunished. Again, this is not talking about the bumping into someone on the premises. This is talking about sexual activity. It's the same kind of language that, again, Paul is using here at the beginning of chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians. But another similarly explicit reference we find in Genesis chapter 20. Genesis chapter 20, we're dealing with Abraham, and he's kind of got what, you know, the sister lie, where he tells his wife to inform everyone that she is Abraham's sister because she's a beautiful woman, and if they think that she's just Abraham's wife, then they'll kill him so she can be their wife. And so he says, as a service to me, do this. Starting in Genesis chapter 20, I'm going to read verses 1 through 7 here. This is a time after, this is after, Lot is freed from Sodom and Gomorrah, but this is Genesis 20. Now Abraham journeyed from there toward the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur. And he sojourned in Gerar. Abraham said to Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. He said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is married. Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, Lord, will you slay a nation even though blameless? Did he not himself say to me, she is my sister? And she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this. Then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this, and I also have kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Again, this was the same kind of way use of this word for touch. That while it can and often does refer to other things, a general touching, or just, you know, touching in general, here Paul is using it, I think, in a specific way when it comes to sexual intimacy. One commentator says, this word is distinguished from another word that also is translated touch, because this word, which is hapto, involves a self-conscious effort to touch. In other words, it's not just an accidental, it's an intentional kind of touching. Which is why in Colossians chapter 2, the same word was translated handle, not just touch, where there's another word at the end of that verse, but it's handle not, taste not, touch not. It's the idea of an intentional touching there. So this is a matter of correspondence, and their statement is, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And that's what they're saying. And Paul's repeating it back to them. And now I think he's going to begin his teaching, trying to correct their false understanding, or their less than perfect understanding. So number two in your outlines there is a matter of holiness. A matter of holiness. Let me read something here if I have it written down. Yeah, Paul is concerned that the sexual desires of men and women, if not properly controlled or directed, would be a source of increased temptation and likelihood to sin. Now, this is interesting because we also have a difficult, I think, interpretational issue here. Is Paul here saying that because of immoralities, each man is to be married? Now, again, some faithful theologians take that as the response. I don't think that's the right response here, because look over in Ephesians chapter 5. Look, just turn over to Ephesians chapter 5. Verse 22, Paul says, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord." Now, Pastor, why are you bringing that up? The language here, I think, is similar enough that in Ephesians 5, Paul is not telling women to get married so that they can be subjected to their own husband. Similarly here, I think Paul is saying that each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband. In other words, this is a command that is not to be fulfilled by getting married, but it's a fulfillment that would be done in marriage. So in other words, the language, I think, or the best understanding is, because of immoralities and the problem that immoralities can plague on a marriage, instead of having this idea that you shouldn't touch a woman, you know, and I'll come back to that in a second here, because of immoralities, each man is to have his wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. And now, I would say we have a similar kind of language understanding when it comes to our own marriage vows. Have you thought about your marriage vows? I sometimes joke about my marriage vows, and when I was doing the green juice fast with my wife, I would rehearse my marriage vows, and for better and for worse, you know, as I'd drink that green, nasty concoction that, again, my wife loves, and I found out that several other people in our church actually enjoy that taste of that nasty kale, but that's okay. You know, I didn't, and I recited, you know, almost as a mantra, not a mantra, but I recited over and over this remembering of my marriage vows. But part of the marriage vows, at least the traditional marriage vows, is when you, the husband and the wife, take one another to have and to hold. To have and to hold. And this is, you know, some may just think of it as poetic language, but to have and to hold is, I think, another reference back to the intimacy that is in marriage. And it's, and while the word particularly here, echo in verse 2, where each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband, it can mean, and most often it just means a general having, like just with no sexual orientation or connotation there. I think we can get I think it's proper to derive that sexual intention there, because in John chapter 4, verse 18, Jesus is dealing with the woman at the well. And he is interacting with her, and he asks her, he says to her, he says, "Go call your husband and come here." And the woman says to him, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, you have correctly said, "I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. This you have said truly." I think the language there is, again, the having that she had with previous husbands and the having that she has with a man that's not her husband is similar in the sense that it's sexual relationship. It is a sexual connection. So I think Paul here is saying, because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband. And he goes on to expound on this for the rest of these verses. And again, this is not a common passage to preach on or to teach on in Bible studies or in sermons, but it's an important reality that we must, as Christians, have a biblical worldview and a biblical understanding of our own marriages and our own duties and our own marriage and what God has intended, so we can live as Christians and not as people of the world. So we have a matter of holiness, because Paul says, because of immoralities, and we've looked at immoralities in the past two chapter, well, really chapter six, when Paul went through this list of sins that characterize those who will not inherit the kingdom of God, in them was various forms and the general immoralities. But because of these problems that can that will ensnare those people whose passions have been awakened, because that's a real problem, each man is to have sexually his wife, and each woman is to have sexually her husband. Now, again, this is so very important and so very practical. I mentioned to the guys in the Bible study last night that there's a billboard for a despicable bar and dancing place up in the cities that has a billboard right around Zumbrota. And the billboard is a picture of, you know, with legs and a woman's legs and her high heels, and it has recently been changed, which is, my wife may be aware of this when she's been going back and forth to see her folks recently, and the wording says, "Let it rain," or no, "Make it rain," excuse me, "Make it rain," an REIGN. Now, their joke is that the place, the name of this establishment, it has, you know, like a king name in it. It's the name, I don't want to say the name of the establishment. I just don't want to do it. But it's got the name of a like an ancient monarch in the name. So in other words, he's going to reign. You know, let the king rule, essentially. But the reality is that there is an abiding problem of immorality and the danger of falling into temptation, giving into temptation. That is more of a concern for those people who have had their passions aroused. My wife will often say to our children, sorry kids for saying this, but she'll say, you know, there are things that we want to keep you from doing and interacting in so as not to awaken your passions before they are to be awakened. In other words, having an awakened passion, awakened desire and appetite for those things that are not proper now is dangerous. I remember back, and I just thought of this today, back to my own, when Stephanie and I were in premarital counseling, I forget exactly how he said it, but the pastor who was counseling us pretty much said it very plainly. He said, "I'll tell you this right now, staying celibate and abstaining from sexual intercourse is much easier when you haven't done it than when you have done it when you weren't supposed to." In other words, staying away from something you don't know, but you're anticipating and desiring in the future is much easier than when you have an experiential knowledge of those things, and those passions have been aroused and awakened. And so Paul says here, because of immoralities, again, because married people understand the joy and the enjoyment of intimacy, you know, don't put those off or abstain from those because of piety. And I think that's one of the underlying things here. There's this, if you just look down to verse 5, Paul says, "Stop depriving one another except for by agreement for a time, so you may devote yourselves to prayer." There was probably this understanding that you could achieve a higher level of some kind of spiritual piety and understanding by depriving yourself of the fleshly, those base fleshly desires and pleasures, and to somehow get yourself to a higher plane. There are various different cults in the ancient world. Some were hypersexualized. In other words, you had the highest form of understanding of God by engaging in sexual activity, usually with a temple prostitute. But others were ones that said the highest is by complete abstinence. I've been following a dialogue about a theological theological argument, I guess, as it relates to oh gracious, and I'm dropping the name of the group. Manichaean, is the Manichees. And in learning about these, the Manichaean kind of influences and the kind of Manichaean religions, which was really weird, one of their prior, one of the highest forms of the most, the highest spiritual you could get there would be a complete divesture from, first of all, you couldn't have intercourse, you couldn't procreate, which again is not a good thing for a religion if you can't procreate, because then it's going to die out. But that was essentially a part of getting to the higher plane of this religious understanding. So you could have either hypersexual or this kind of hyper being completely disconnected from those things. And that's very likely maybe one of the responses in Corinth, because of their debauched society, well, we must be as far away from that as possible. So it's good to not touch a woman. Even though you're married, it's good not to do it, because that'll help you be more with the Lord. And that's not, and Paul says here, but because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife and each woman to have her own husband. Again, I don't think it's a command that you are to then fulfill in marriage or by being married, but it's a command that you can fulfill when you're in marriage. In other words, by coming together in the sexual part of marriage. So that's the, it's a matter of holiness. Because again, I think the Corinth was a perverse place full of all kinds of sexual immorality and opportunity. And our culture is very similar. And Christian men and Christian women need to know that if one or the other, whatever the motivation is, continually saying no to these things, no to proper sexual intercourse in your marriage, that can be detrimental for one and for both. There's a quote that I had here that I wanted to read. Let me just see if I can find it here quick. Yeah, Paul takes for granted that the only rightful place for sexual intercourse is within marriage, and that those who marry are sexually active. For them to attempt to suppress awakened sexual desires will only expose them to a sexual undertow that will tug them into a sea of temptation where they will ultimately drown. So this is a matter of holiness there in verse 2. So it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband. Number 3 there on your outlines, it is a matter of obligation, a matter of obligation. Now, I'll just say this here for a moment. There's so much about this section here that is radically countercultural. To say that in our society there is an obligation within marriage at all is difficult. But to say that there's obligations to a spouse as it comes to sexual activity, that seems, well, backwards, archaic, all kinds of things. And I think Paul does a very a good job here of properly putting this all in context. And we'll get to some things in here that I think will keep the Christian faithful husband and faithful wife and loving spouse in a tolerant in a very workable living relationship as it comes to sexuality. But the reality is there is an obligation that a wife has to her husband and that a husband has to her wife. In the Old Testament, I forget the reference, I should have looked it up. But if a man takes a second wife, he's not to essentially deprive his first wife of her proper food, her proper shelter, or her marital rights. Those things that she is due. And again, part of that would be, sorry, I hit my microphone there. Part of that is related to the fact that wealth and inheritance was passed on through heirs, and so to deprive a woman of sexual intimacy would deprive her of any way of being taken care of in her later life. So, but more than that, there is this obligation, and nowadays there is an obligation even between husbands and wives. So it's a matter of obligation. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. Now, we'll get to, well, this is countercultural. First of all, because Paul is saying not just that the wife has to do with the husband, her duty to the husband, but the husband has a duty to the wife. Now, that is a very important equalizing of the playing field here in a lot of respects. That it's not just the unwilling wife or the whatever, or the wife is subject to the husband's desires only as a one-way street. It's not that way. There is an obligation one to the other. The picture here, the word here for translated fulfill, must fulfill, is used for fulfilling various responsibilities. Or, in other words, it refers to an obligation or an expectation. In Matthew, Jesus says in chapter 5, you shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. In other words, he's talking about the fulfilling there of these vows. That it's, you have made this vow to the Lord, you are obligated then to fulfill it. Now again, not sitting on a throne and commanding obligation from wife or from husband, but there is an obligation in marriage for sexual intimacy. It's this word is translated here, fulfill, is translated as the word render when Jesus talks about, when he answers the taxation question, render to Caesar what is Caesar's. In other words, fulfill that obligation to Caesar with what is his. Or Paul says in Romans 13, render to all what is due them. In other words, speaking of obeying those in authority over us, give them what is their due, the obligation there. And so there is this responsibility. And the nice, the hopeful thing is that in marriage, obviously, sexual intimacy is not merely hopefully a drudging drudging task. Sexual intimacy ought to be made. It is made for both procreation, which is important, but also enjoyment. Some actually have taken this in the history of the church, have taken this the only reason to have sexual intercourse inside of marriage is because of procreation. And any other time is just, kind of as a way to forestall further immorality. You know, it's kind of doing this thing you ought not to do, this kind of icky thing for these these necessary reasons. Otherwise, don't do it. That's not the picture. Sex was made to be enjoyed inside of marriage. Just in Proverbs chapter 5, verses 18 and 19, it says this, let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breasts satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. It is not merely to be this stagnant, transactional situation. It is to be enjoyed. And so, this is a duty that we have, that in marriage we are to fulfill, because of it is a duty, but we ought not to, hopefully we don't think of it as a grudging, burdensome thing. Now, sin can mess all kinds of stuff up. Sin can make all things kind of difficult and not fun. If someone had, if a person was sexually assaulted in the past, that could make intimacy a very difficult thing for a long time, if not always, because of that sin that was done in that regard. If there was pornography or other kinds of immorality or adultery done, that's going to make it difficult to fulfill these obligations. And we'll get into loving and all this, and how I think Christians we ought to walk through these things. But sin can really make this problematic. And so to young people, I always encourage to stay as far away from immorality as possible and things that will put you in a situation where you will have sexual baggage, because the hope is that in marriage, well, marriage is the place where sex is to be enjoyed. And to try to make that as positive and as good as possible, stay far from immorality now. Wow, I gotta hurry up. Okay, so that was obligation. There is this duty to fulfill. Again, sometimes this word is used, the word for duty is used of a financial obligation, but it is something that is owed and is, you know, obligatory between husband and wife. And again, like I said, this is countercultural. We're gonna get something that was countercultural in Paul's day that's not in our day, but it was then. And so this was a section that's always been controversial. Number four there is a matter of authority. A matter of authority. Okay, verse 4. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, also, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. This word authority is used four times in the New Testament, three times by Paul, and three times in the last 20 verses. Twice here in this verse, and then one goes back to verse 12 in chapter 6, where he says, I will not be mastered by anything. He's talking about that there's this mastery or authority. It comes from the root word of exousia, which talks about authority or power. That in a marriage, husbands, your wife has as much say over what you do physically, what you do with your body, particularly when it comes to sexual activity, as she has as much say as you do, and you do of her body as she does. This is, your body is not your own in that regard. Now again, this is not to be in a perpetual sense of subservience or whatever it might be, because I think we have we have an authority, but also when it comes to particularly in Christian marriage, we know that we ought to love one another. Husbands are to love their wives as Christ loved the church, and young women are to learn to love their husbands and love their children. We are to love one another. So practically, how does this work out? And this is, I've said this in premarriage counseling and whatever else. When it comes to, well, in premarriage counseling, I always say there are really three things that cause conflict in marriage. One is communication. That's usually the biggest one. Second one is money. If you're not taking care of your money together and on the same page, you have problems. Third is sexual intimacy. Those are the three of the most common places for conflict in a marriage. So what does it mean that a wife doesn't have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and vice versa? That doesn't mean that a Christian husband ought to come, you know, as much as he wants, whenever he wants, and demand intimacy, or vice versa. It is not always the husband who desires and the wife who doesn't, or whatever it might be. It's not monolithic in that sense. Our culture paints men as insatiable dogs and more than anything else. And well, that's probably true in a lot of ways. The reality is that the everybody is different. So one spouse, husband and wife, ought not to walk into a Christian marriage and just demand that these things be fulfilled. I encourage husbands and wives to have this mentality. That your initial reaction, you want to strive to have your initial response to your spouse, if they want to be intimate, you want it to be a yes. You want it to be a yes. And if not, then not, but you want to try to, if your spouse says, I would like to be intimate, or however that comes about in your relationship, then the response on the other spouse should be, yes, that I will strive to be joyful in that with you and for you. I keep on hitting my mic here. But also, The one who says, maybe brings up and says, who wants intimacy, also loves. And so that if the other spouse doesn't want, is not able to, for doesn't desire, is that it, whatever it might be, that then there's going to be, the loving response is going to not press one's marital rights and love the spouse by waiting. I don't think this is properly expressed in a demandy when you're going to have intimacy, and it's got to be whenever I want it and every time I want it. I think the Christian understands the obligation there, but also understands that I can love my wife or she can love me by sometimes, but by saying no. I'd love to, but apparently not now, and that's okay. Again, this is idea of obligation and doing something joyfully out of that love for one another, because there is this wanting the other person to be lifted up and to be encouraged and to keep them free from immorality, those kinds of things, is good. So this authority is part of it. And again, that's pretty countercultural. That my wife has authority over my body. I have authority over my wife's body, and vice versa, in a marriage. And that's just a proper, humble understanding of those things is helpful for sexual, a healthy sexual life inside of marriage. And again, if guys, if your wife has caught you looking at pornography, trust me, you are not being loving or acting as a faithful Christian brother or husband to demand sexual sex. That's just it. And if, women, I can't think of the perfect corresponding one to that, play the side. But ultimately, sin messes these things up. And I've talked to more men who say they desire intimacy with their wives, but they've wrecked it themselves and made it difficult because they have wrecked it with pornography, other kinds of immorality. And if that's you, gentlemen, if that was you recently, then know that it might take a long time. It might take a while for some of the joyful things to come back. And you better be careful how hard you press out of love for your spouse when you were a dog. Well, verse 5 and 6, this is a matter of concession, Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so you may devote yourselves to prayer and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this by way of concession, not of command. Now, here is where this is counterculture in Paul's day. You may say, what's weird about that? The idea that there's going to be this consensual abstention, in other words, you both agree, where the wife and the husband would agree, that is radical different in Paul's day, even in the Jewish mind. Jews, there was some rabbinical tradition that a husband could abstain from sex in a marriage for prayer, but a wife didn't have that same kind of ability, in the tradition to be able to do that. In other words, if he chose to, that was it. If he didn't, it wasn't possible. In Paul's day and age, if a husband was going to make a decision, a significant decision, he'd ask his friends, his compadres, about what to do. He would tell his wife what they were doing. He wouldn't interact with her and agree about things. When it comes to sexual intercourse, to have this only at a time of agreement, have a time you're going to abstain from sex so that you can pray and devote yourselves to holiness, because that's, again, I think what some of them were thinking. Only do it then. And then don't do it for too long so that you're not going to be tempted. But Paul here says, I say this by way of concession, not of command. He's not commanding you to abstain from sex and pray. In other words, you can pray while not being abstinent in your marriage, just like you can pray while not fasting from food. If you desire to do that for whatever reason, as long as your wife agrees or as long as your husband agrees, then okay, but only if you have to. He says that as a concession, not he's saying not to do that as a way for holiness. In other words, I think that their idea was abstaining from sexuality, at least some of the people in the church, by doing that, I achieve a higher level. And the husband was saying this, the wife was saying this, and depriving the other spouse of their marital obligation and rights, and therefore it was causing problems. And Paul says, only do that if there's agreement, and that's only a concession. Not because I'm saying you ought to do those things. It's a matter of concession. And finally, verse 7, a matter of giftedness, a matter of giftedness. Yet I wish that all men were as myself. However, each man has his own gift from God, and one in this matter and another in that. Very, very simply, we'll get to this more as we go on. But Paul had the gift of celibacy, of singleness, I think. And what that means is that he didn't have the desire for a wife. That he was he desired more to be free of those obligations. That he could then put his whole energy into gospel ministry. This is not the same as saying someone has the gift of singleness. And they're going to spend all their time doing things that they want to do and spending time on their own hobbies and pleasures. And then you'll go to church once in a while. That's not the same thing. This is Paul saying that he gets to the picture of those who have this gift of singleness, who are like he is, are those who are not hindered by worldly concerns, but can put all of their attention, all of their energy into doing work for Christ. So, again, we cover a lot of difficult subjects when we walk through the Bible, a lot of subjects that maybe aren't necessarily normal in Bible studies. But it's important to know that, again, the only proper place for sexual intimacy is inside of a heterosexual monogamous marriage. And part of that marriage, part of those vows, is to take care of all the needs of one another, but including that is this vow, this obligation of sexual intimacy. And there is this, the wife has authority and rights over the husband's body there's an obligation of the husband to be intimate with his wife and vice versa. And so much so that the Christian, we are to consider husbands that are our bodies are not merely our own, but our wife has authority over our bodies and vice versa. But again, that the Christian is not going to use that as a bludgeon, as a bow to my whims. And the wife's not going to have that bow to my whims and I'm the one in control here kind of thing. It's going to be this mutual, loving, interactive relationship. And that's with sin, that's awfully difficult to navigate because we mess stuff up. But the hope is that as you strive and continue to be holy with Christ, that this area will be a part of your life that you can bring more and more into conformity with the Lord. Any questions? Please direct them to Lon. I'm just kidding, Lon. No, please feel free to call Lon. No, but any questions on this? Please talk to me because I know again, marriage is great, and marriage can be so good and enjoyable on so many levels. But I do know that some of the hardships come when it comes to sexual intimacy, and if it's a result of sin on one or both partners, then that can complicate things. But again, this is a tough thing to get through, and it is my prayer that we would continue to be people who are submissive to the Lord and conform more to the image of Christ and conform by His Word than we are to the world. Would you please pray with me as I close this here? Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for your kindness to us. Lord, bless us this evening. May we, in our lives, in all areas, not just sexuality, but in all areas, may we be conformed to you and to your word and do what you have said is honorable and think what you have, think things are good that you have said are good. Think your thoughts. May we strive to honor you in our marriages. May husbands strive to love our wives, and wives, may they strive to love their husbands. We thank you in Christ's name. Amen.